Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. It's going to be just me today. Well, just me and our guest. And our guest today is Rick Lenz. Now, he's a graduate of the University of Michigan, past member of the Actors Studio, and active member in the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which I think means he gets to vote on the Oscar winners. He's a veteran Broadway television and film actor who first came to national attention when he repeated his Broadway role in Cactus Flower in the film version opposite Goldie Hawn, Ingrid Bergman, and Walter Matthau. And he went on to appear in quite a lot of television series and movies. He's also a playwright and author, including the award-winning The Alexandrite and more recently Impersonators Anonymous. His memoir, North of Hollywood, has recently been published in its second edition, and the book we're talking about today is Hello, Rest of My Life. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Rick.
Oh, thank you for having me on, Monica.
So, I got to say, Hello, Rest of My Life must be at least semi-autobiographical.
I remember I gave it to my son. My eldest son to read, and he said, well, it's just about you, Dad. So it's not exactly autobiographical, but it sure is based on me and my wife, Linda.
And so, yeah. In Hello, Rest of My Life, the character, Danny Maitrey, has been married over 40 years. And is that true of you also?
That's true of me as well. I saw no reason to obfuscate that. And, so, you know, a lot of places where, you know, you can use as a novelist your imagination. Sometimes when you're writing kind of close to the bone, you know, there's no particular reason to, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. So that's my opinion anyway.
So obviously you must really be in love with your wife, because Danny is so in love with Samantha in this story.
That's true. That's true. I don't know. It was a very lucky thing in my life when Linda and I met, because she's just, well, she's walked into the room, so I'm turning red as I say. she means, you know, she is the world, just about literally to me, and especially when in these later days, you know, when you kind of tend to want to just say, oh, go on and do what you do out there, and I'll, you know, do what I need to do as a citizen, but otherwise I'm not going to get wrapped up in all the craziness. And so I'm very wrapped up in my whole life and my family, and Linda especially.
Well, the sweetness of it really, really shows through in this book, and yet I don't want to make people think that's all there is to this. It's not just a love story. There's a whole lot more. So Rick, why don't you tell us, what is Hello, Rest of My Life about?
Well, the title is based on kind of something that did happen to my wife and I. We kind of met, spent a little time together, a few weeks, and then I had to do a job, and we broke off. And then both of us were kind of upset about that moment, but we went on because we both had things we were doing. And then when we became free a month later, I called her, and then we got together, and I remember her walking up a certain set of stairs, and the title of the book actually occurred to me just, you know, in whole, you know, all the rest of my life, because I really thought that I'd found what I wanted, and it seemed to me that it worked reciprocally. So it just felt like a tie-in, yeah. And it, when I came up with the title when I was beginning this novel, I thought, oh, that's just perfect. I love working with something that has that title, because that's the way it's always felt. And the character in the book does, you know, has that as his driving force from the beginning.
That this woman, Samantha, that he meets and falls in love with, is he sees her as the rest of his life. And the most, by far the most important aspect of his life, more so than career or other ambitions.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. I mean, so that's the beginning of it.
Yes.
But then what happens?
Well, then he always has, I mean, and some of these things I can cross over into myself. You always have, because I was kind of had, as they say out here in Hollywood, I had some heat in the business for a while because I did repeat a Broadway role in a movie, and it was a successful movie, and so there was a lot of interest in me and from the people who, you know, run the studios and were doing this project or that, and so I had that. And it was very seductive, and I worked for a while just, you know, kind of on the basis of being, having that lucky thing having happened to me. And it's so seductive that because I had worked for that kind of success, not necessarily in that form, all I originally wanted to be was a good actor and to work. And this was happening in a way that was beyond my wildest dreams. And in a way, looking back, it's not a thing I would wish on people. I know a lot of, or have known a lot of successful, very successful actors. And a lot of them are not that happy in terms of the success and the attention paid them and the kind of unreality that Hollywood can be in personal terms, and on a lot of terms, I guess. So anyway, to answer your question or try to, I finally, all the way through my life, even with Linda, I thought, well, I could have done that role or that. And once in a while, something will come up on the fringes and somebody will say, do you want to do this? And I'll say, I don't know. I kind of gave that up now, as of about 15 years ago, and to write. And so it's always there. So he kind of, out of his deep unconscious, I guess, wishes himself back. And I won't go into the details of how that happens to his previous existence. And I had a very nice home in Beverly Hills. And he finds himself, my protagonist, Danny, finds himself in that home and with a second chance to do it right this time, as he had made some mistakes the first time through. And the only problem is that he gets back and he gets that chance, and it's still the same Hollywood, but he's now without Samantha. And so that turns it all around. And then from that point on, all he wants to do is to get back to Samantha, but
he doesn't know how. Barrier. Yeah, he doesn't know how to do that. But he does know how to maybe have a bigger, more successful career.
Yes.
But he's not really sure he wants it.
Exactly so. Yes.
Yeah. And so that's the question. If you could do it all again, would you actually want the thing that you thought you wanted that you didn't get?
Oh, nobody's asked me that question quite that way, and I don't know. I would like it if I knew what I know now, maybe, because I would dismiss the dismissible part of it, which is the kind of cliche Hollywood shallow part, which I didn't dismiss the first time. I said, oh yeah, this is wonderful, whatever it was. It was kind of, I don't know, it was just surface, and it was like a shiny thing, and the shiny things can be misleading, as you know.
Yes,
And so anyway, I would find myself, I guess, just making smarter choices. I remember one thing that happened to me the first time back. I got a movie from Disney, and I got a nice role in a Disney movie, and it was all those many years ago, and I had a meeting with Peter Bogdanovich for the movie that made him big, which was I think the Last Picture Show.
The Last Picture Show.
Yes, that's it. With Sybil Shepherd and
right.
Can't think of the lead young man's name. But anyway, so I was not offered at all. I was talking to him about one of the roles in that. And he said, if you take that movie, and I'd already been offered that Disney movie, he said, it'll ruin your career. And I thought, well, and by that time he hadn't done much. Peter hadn't. And I said, yeah, right. I'm going to turn down a nice fat role in a movie that would have me working for 3 or 4 months and around the country. And I was really looking forward to that, except there was probably some truth in what he said, because at that time, what Disney was doing in terms of was what they used to do. And it was kind of not animated, cartoony. And I thought it was a good script, but turned out it was not a successful film. So there went a year. And those times in an actor's career, you don't want to see a year roll by and nothing happen. Mm. And that's what happened. Yeah.
So you wouldn't do that. But
things.
You know, things would happen differently, and who knows?
Exactly.
Who knows? Exactly. Now, one thing you might do if you had to go back to do all over again is buy Apple stock.
Yes. Absolutely.
Knowing what you know now.
Oh, my, yes. Oh, I did another time travel book, The Alexandrite, and I did have him buy, I think he bought a lot of things like baseball cards and, you know, things that were... you could hold in your hand.
Yeah. So he knew which baseball players would become superstars, and their rookie cards would become valuable. And that would be the thing to do. So in Hello, Rest of My Life, Danny Maitrey is a former actor turned writer, and he writes time travel books, and you write time travel books. So is this your second time travel book?
Well, the previous book, The Impersonators Anonymous, is not exactly time. It's not time travel. It just goes back and forth in time.
Okay.
So it's not strictly a time travel book. It's just that the area of Hollywood that I know is not the area that is of the mostly the 21st century. I don't know very much about, but I know a great deal about the 60s, 70s, and 80s in Hollywood. And so it's just wiser of me as a writer to write what I do know instead of having to rely strictly on research.
That's a good point. And having lived through the time makes it a lot easier. Do you have a good memory for details in the past?
I do pretty well at that. I can't say I'm superhuman at it or anything like that, but I do remember stuff very well. And the fact is that in this book, Hello, Rest of My Life, I do, I lived through both times. So it makes it a lot easier to write. After 50 years, it qualifies as a historical fiction. 50 or 60, I'm not sure.
Yeah, So that's a little scary.
Yes, it is. I try not to think about that.
I know. It's like it's like the furniture I grew up with is probably considered antique now.
Sure. Oh, I know that kind of stuff. Oh, yeah. I've got a sweater. I don't know why I think of this, but I have a sweater my mom bought me. I think it's definitely, it's over 60 years old.
It's vintage.
Yes, I know. And which reminds me, and I don't need reminding, that I'm vintage, I guess.
Yeah. Well, vintage is a good thing. My mother always says, and unfortunately, she's not able to join us for our interview today.
Oh, I'm sorry, she couldn't. Yeah.
But she always said something about, growing old isn't for sissies.
Oh, yeah.
But it's better than the alternative.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Especially when, life is going along, and you kind of do. I don't know about everybody, but a lot of people I know, and I know for myself, you get better at it somehow. You learn a few things and you learn things you don't want to do anymore. and things that you might be better off doing that you didn't before. So it's not the time to leave, you know, to want to leave.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. And I'm not quite, you know, I'm looking forward to the day. I'm getting closer, but when I'm old enough that I really don't care what anyone else thinks about anything I do.
Well, I'm getting there. There's just not much point in my caring too much that, you know, what people's opinions of me are. I try to be a good human, and that's all I can do. So, it's not all I can do, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm going to ask you, Rick, to read a little bit from Hello, Rest of My Life.
I would love to. But I went to a doctor last week and said, stop eating late at night because it's messing with your vocal cords. So I have done that, which I'm always a big midnight snacker. And I guess it's best not to do that on a regular basis, which I always did. And so anyway, it affects my vocal cords. So excuse me for my kind of rough sound right now. But,
I had no idea that could be a problem, and I really wish I didn't know.
<I'm sorry. laughs> Yeah, no, I'm told that as a rule, it's best not to eat late at night, at least on a regular basis.
Yeah, but what if you're European, you know? You have to eat late at night.
Well, that's true, isn't it? But don't you think if you have 9 o'clock dinner in Spain, France, or Italy, that you're finished basically by 11, then you don't go to bed till 1 or 2 anyway, right?
Well, so that's a good point. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll just take a crack at this and go with chapter 1.
All right.
Chapter 1, 2021, Samantha. I live with my wife, Samantha, in Valley Glen in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. I never thought I'd have it this good. It feels in some part of me that I loved Sam even before I stood outside her apartment, anxious from blind date nerves. She answered the doorbell, looked puzzled, then relieved, and said, "Not bad." I didn't know what to say to that, so I grinned and said, "Hi, I'm Danny Mitri." She took my hand, smiled warmly at me, and said, "It's nice to know you." You just don't get good blind dates. At least I never had. I've had this flu that keeps hanging on, but it's getting better, I think. Are you divorced? Yes, a few years now, I say. You're an amateur, says this date. That won't work out for either of us. I'm a three-time loser, but my shrink says that's all behind me, and he should know, I guess, which she doesn't explain. But Samantha, who says not bad, has no problems, or doesn't tell me about them on the first date, a blind one, which is odd. Her eyes, I could fall into those eyes. She speaks of this and that, and so do I. It doesn't matter, because I just fell in love with her in her doorway. Or maybe I'd loved her even before that, so I came in and stayed. A little break, and then... One night early in our years together, Samantha seemed to have drifted off to sleep, lying on her stomach. As I was about to turn off the lights, she said quietly, "Pet me." I didn't move for a few minutes, trying to decide exactly what that meant. No one had ever said anything like that to me. Something about the confidence of that sort of command amazed me. It combined self-domination with trust, self-dominion with trust, as if in her life, when seemingly insignificant requests had been made, they had been automatically granted, and I was going to grant this one, and it felt good. I rolled over on one elbow and gently, beginning over one eyebrow, stroked Sam's forehead, moving my hand softly over her light brown hair to behind her ear. At first, it felt sort of odd to me, petting her, but pretty soon I fell into a tender and natural rhythm. I lightly smoothed back her hair, concentrating on doing it so that even if she were still awake, she might be almost unaware she was being petted. And I got lost in a ritual kind of affection I didn't even know I was capable of. I slid my right hand down to her neck and left shoulder and as far down her back as I could comfortably reach without disturbing her rest. Eventually, I stroked up and down her left arm until I reached her hand. It was smooth, but it was also the hand of a peasant girl made to work, to do labor. At the same time, there was a graceful vulnerability to her hand. I studied her in the lamplight, her face relaxed and at peace. I was pretty sure she would be sleeping serenely, even if I weren't lying next to her. It was nice being a part of that peace. It made me feel calm, and I began to get sleepy. It could have been 5 or 15 minutes later when I rolled over, turned off my bedside lamp, and dropped off to sleep. Another little break. I had a bad day yesterday. I'm working on a new novel, a time travel story that was coming along beautifully, I thought, but now it's making no sense at all. I painted myself into a corner, and I don't see any way out of it. I had stupid notion on top of stupid notion, and for the rest of the day, I couldn't let go of the careening thoughts and sensations that reminded me of my loose cannon younger days, when, as often as not, I employed the whole nest of my malevolent emotional demons to steer my life. It feels as if I'm trying to bludgeon the story in my novel with identical finesse. Before dawn today, it was still dark out, I woke up and started rehashing my problems, a real effective technique for beginning a happy day. A little while later, Sam woke up and asked me what the trouble was. I told her, and she suggested I try to get some more sleep. I heaved a big sigh and lay down beside her. The next thing I knew, she was running her fingers over my head, caressing my neck, shoulders, and upper back, petting me. And when I woke up, I felt better. Over 40 years after we met, Sam and I are having our magic hour before dinner. The light is a cinematographer's dream. The day's toil is done, and our dog Tally is at our feet. At the moment, his chin is resting on my left foot, which is getting all pins and needles because I don't want to disturb his peaceful sleep. Anyway, as far as the three of us are concerned, all is well with the world. At the moment, we're reminiscing an activity, I confess, usually initiated by me. After we'd been together a few weeks, you called and said you wanted to come over and talk about something, says Samantha. I thought, he's either going to ask me to marry him or he's going to break up with me. A whisper of sadness mixed with surprise. And you broke up with me. I was going off to do a job. I didn't want to leave me hanging. Well, exactly. I was trying to, I don't know, do the right thing. She sips her wine and says, you probably thought I was a snob because I didn't like that tacky restaurant you took me to where they had mashed potatoes and gravy. Well, you were kind of snarky about it, I say. You know how you can get snarky? Well, you got snarky. Up until that night, I had only taken you to nice places. I was bummed out that night, she says. I thought, oh, God, I really liked him, but he's ordinary. He likes this depressing place. Maybe it hit me that way because I'd been raised in Carbon Falls. You can't find a more depressing little patch of Pennsylvania until I was 10 and we moved out here. And it was visceral. That little restaurant felt like scrimping and saving and S&H green stamps. Anyway, if you take me to the Cupid's hot dog stand on the corner that night, I would have been fine. I would have been delighted. And then you would have asked me to marry you. I still would have said it's too soon. But she looks down into her wine. And then you broke up with me. But none of that was the reason. You were too nice, I say. I remember when I got back from location in Portland and I called you. Do you remember what went through your mind? Well, I was glad you were still interested in me, she says, because in the meantime, you've been gone for how long? I'm not sure, I say. As you know, once in a while, my mind and the conventional notion of time drift a little out of sync. I guess I was gone about a month, I smile, if you don't count the forever before the month. Sam smiles back. Yeah, well, in the meantime, I went to Palm Springs with Mike. I was sad. Mike was her previous boyfriend. She dated him off and on for 10 years. He married someone else after Sam and I got together the next and forever time. You were still sad about me, I say, a month after we said goodbye? Sure I was. I'd started to care about you. You broke up with me. And, of course, you were important to me in another way. But she gazes into my eyes. Then you went off to do that whatever job in Portland. But I thought, well, okay, he doesn't want this relationship. I'll go to Palm Springs and spend some time with Mike, with my mother and Grace. I smile at the mention of Grace's name. Sam goes on, I'll just try to get on with it. So when you called and said, do you remember what you said? I think I said, I miss you. I don't want to see you. She frowns. Yeah. So why did I come to you? I don't know. But you got in the car and drove over to my apartment. Did you think it was weird that I came to you, not the other way around? No, I say. I didn't think it was weird. Actually, I was kind of flattered. If I'd been one of those girls who was savvy about guys, the ones who know how to play all the games, I didn't know how to do that. I did, I say. I'm afraid that sometimes I was sort of trying to be a player until you came along. But a smart friend of mine said, why don't you join a church group or something? Meet a girl that way. I thought he was crazy and tossed that idea out. But the drift of his advice floated around in my mind until I understood what he meant. He thought, as I looked for someone to be with for life, that I should do it not only on the basis of physical attraction, but also that it might be a good idea if she was, what a concept, a nice person. Sam says, well, anyway, I got in the car and came to you. It shocked me that I did that. I'd always been so cautious. Having divorced parents makes you that way. She shrugs. Didn't seem to matter, though. I came to you. Also, I had to think of other people. I had to give you one more chance. I nod. I buzzed the front door and came out of my apartment and met you coming up the stairs, he says. And I felt like Sam smiles. I've told her this before. Hello, rest of my life? Yeah. Hello, rest of my life. Yes. That's what it felt like. It was the closest thing I'd ever felt to total. Is there a word that combines relief and joy? Her impossibly blue eyes twinkle. Euphoria? She's joking, but I'm not. Yes, that's it. Euphoria.
Thank you.
That's
and that's
You're welcome.
Chapter one of Hello, Rest of My Life by Rick Lenz.
Yes.
Read to by Rick Lenz. And you are, you know, despite your vocal cord issues, you are a pleasure to listen to.
Oh, thank you so much. It's very kind of you, Monica. I appreciate it.
So how did you actually go from being a working actor to being a working writer? It seems like that might be a difficult transition to make.
Well, it's difficult in some ways, I suppose. But I think for a lot of actors, it's sort of natural because you're basically dealing with literary material on one level or another. You know, almost always in play form or screenplay form in your work. And in my case, when I got out of theater school at University of Michigan, I was almost instantly offered a job as a director of a new civic theater in my hometown, which was Jackson, Michigan. And I naturally just jumped up and my head hit the ceiling when I was offered that. And so I went to Jackson, and in the next 2 years I chose 12 plays, and I built the stage and I hung the lights and cast the plays, and it was just wonderful fun. Except the thing that crossed my mind, and I'd always liked writing, I had written it, you know, before I was in college and during college, and had enjoyed the process, and I thought, God, I wish one of these plays that I'm directing could have something to do with the creation of. Mm. And so I kept working on that, and I began writing little tiny vignette-y kind of things, you know, boy meets girl meets boy, would you like a cup of coffee, I don't know, you live near here, that stuff like that, just stupid little kind of primitive sort of material. And then I just kept doing that between engagements, as it were, and I got better, and I started having plays done. I had one done on PBS in New York in the
wow,
I guess early 70s. Yeah, it was wonderful, and it had been done off Broadway and done by good actors. So I just started doing that on a regular basis, and I wrote a few plays during my acting career that I was in, and a couple that I wasn't, and so I always enjoyed that. And when I got to a certain point, I just I realized that the acting is, for me, and this is not certainly universally the case at all, but based in Los Angeles as I was now, and I was not about to pick up and go back east, and where a lot of theater careers, you know, are kind of based, and theater acting careers anyway. And so I decided that the roles that I was being offered, that I was having the chance to read for, or whatever the case was, weren't as meaty or as much fun as I'd been doing, you know, since I started when I was 17 doing summer stock, and I was, you know, about into my 60s, and I thought I really liked the writing more than I liked the acting. And yet, if you want to have an acting career, you got to keep at it. You got to keep doing workshops and studying and being in plays, and that would take 3-4 months to be in a play, to rehearse it and to have and to run it, and then maybe they pay attention to you or not, and they increasingly don't pay attention to you when you get later in your acting career. So I thought, I really do enjoy the writing more. So I just said to my acting agent, you could just leave me alone unless you hear from Spielberg. I'd rather do my writing. And I continued to write plays for a while. Then I thought, that's even a dicey, long way to go around business. And I love reading books, always have, and novels. And so I said, why don't I just try to concentrate on that? So that's what I've been doing ever since. And so I just came up yesterday with my new idea for my next one. I mean, I think to the point where I think it's really going to work. Uh-huh. And so, yeah, it's very exciting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Rick Lenz, author of Hello, Rest of My Life. So how did you get your first book published?
I did it myself.
Okay.
I had an agent in New York for a number of years, and she finally gave up on me because I was still in the learning process of how you write a novel. I knew quite a bit about how to construct a play, but I really didn't know, you know, the finer points of writing a novel. And so I got a lot of help. A couple of good writers, well, several good writers helped me directly, and I was influenced by several others, and I read a lot of books about it. And my wife knew a woman named Dale Ellis, and Linda told Dale that I was writing a novel, and she said, would you like me to give it to my son? He's a novelist. And it was Bret Easton Ellis who wrote, you know, a lot of books that a lot of people are kind of have strong feelings about, but he is a very technically wonderful writer. He's edited some of the great writers along the way, and he just was terribly generous with me, read my stuff, said, you know, just said terrible things about what I was writing, how I was doing it. But I find that a lot of times that happens. Writers are really hard on writers, and I have learned that for the most part, That's a good thing, because you're not going to learn by being, you know, given words of soothing words of, oh, that's nice, that's very nice, when it's not. So it was a good thing that he told me in the, you know, simplest and sometimes blunt terms possible, you know, what I was doing wrong and what I might be starting to do right.
And just for listeners, Bret Easton Ellis wrote American Psycho, one of his. So, and many other books. Yeah.
Rules of Attraction, I think, was the first one.
So you got some harsh feedback.
Oh yes, very harsh feedback. And I have other friends who I didn't know were writers, and some who became writers during the time I knew them. Elizabeth Forsyth Haley, who wrote a book called Woman of Independent Means, is a longtime friend. I was in a play adaptation of a book she wrote called Joanna's Husband, David's Wife, at the Pasadena Playhouse out here. And so she took an interest in my novel writing, too, and was helpful. And so that's also been, a boon. May I interrupt for a second to say I was going to tell you that the cover designer of all my books so far and all my books into the future, I hope, lives where you do, in Fairfield, right?
Oh, George Foster?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. He's a lovely man, and his wife Mary is lovely.
Oh, yes, yes. George is an incredibly talented book cover designer, and he's been on Writers' Voices talking about that in the past.
Has he? Well, that seems like a good. I'd love to hear that.
Yeah.
Because I'm very fond of George, and he's oh so good at what he does.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I don't have the hardcover of yours, so I only have a PDF, so I haven't seen the cover.
So, oh, okay. So you could see it on like one of those on-site things. They show an image of it.
Yeah.
If you're interested.
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to do that right now. Oh yeah, there.
Okay.
Yeah, that's great. That's very striking. Hello, rest of my life. So anyway, you were you said you decided to self-publish your first novel.
Yes, I did, and that was an experience, and it's just one of those things that you learn as you go. And I didn't do a lot of things I should have, and probably vice versa. And it's been the case all along. I would like to have, I guess, a big publishing house do my books, but. I just do love the control that I have, and I found an editor early on who was marvelous, and so he's my Maxwell Perkins, is it? I think.
Yes.
And so he tells me when I've written a page or two or more that just don't make any sense where I have them in the book and. That kind of thing, as well as giving me the Chicago Manual of Style, sentence-to-sentence help that I need. I think that every writer needs, or most do anyway. Unless you're Stephen King or Richard Russo or Ann Tyler, one of those people.
Right. And who knows? They may be getting that kind of help, too, for all we know. It's just.
Well, I bet they are, yeah. I know that Maxwell Perkins helped, I guess. Thomas Wolfe.
F. Scott Fitzgerald.
And
I'm trying to
think.
Was
it Hemingway?
Hemingway, yep.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, he knew what he was doing, didn't he?
Yeah. So how do you get your books, how do you get people to know about your books? Doing shows like this, but do you have other ways?
Yeah. I almost would like to put my wife on, but I won't do that. She's in the other room doing what she does. We just get them out every way we can. We pay attention to every reputable seeming source of how to run publicity. We used a company called Books Forward for this book, and we have a woman that we work with named Carrie Lee Barnum it's called New Shelves, and she and Linda talk very early our time, because it just works out that because we're 3 hours different. And I do a lot of writing at night, so my clock is all Fakakta, and I get up late, and so sometimes I miss those calls. Anyway, so we do everything we can to get out to libraries and bookstores and to call people's attention to it. We run ads and Facebook and so on, and all the on-site.
You have Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all of those things?
Yes, yeah. All those things. Part of me likes to do, and part of me, you know, it's a labor. It's a labor that takes me away from the writing, which is why I'm doing this. And that's the one part of being an actor I kind of miss, and that is that somebody else did all of that, and then they just said go to work. And in this case, I have to do that, and then with Linda's wonderful help. In fact, I help her in terms of the publishing. I mean, in terms of in terms of the publishing and production and advertising of the book and books.
And I think maybe writers today don't realize, even if you're publishing with a major publishing house, you still have to do all those things.
Oh, you do.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they do their blast, and then that's it.
Yeah. And then it's up to you, and you're, do book clubs or do book readings. Of course, in the age of COVID, it's mostly remote, but it's hard. Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. So in Hello, Rest of My Life, your character Danny Maitre finds himself inexplicably thrust back into time, into 1974, right. And he's trying to get back to his wife. He doesn't actually seem to want to relive his life all that much. He really just wants to get back to Samantha. But the one thing about this book that I think I really need to bring out is there's a huge spiritual element.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about why and how it affects the book.
Well, I'll just tell you from my point of view, first of all, it's a, when I was being in the early 70s out here and having some good fortune in the business, in the acting business, I realized at some point that it was making me crazy. So I got some psychotherapy for a while. And then that time was passed, and I'd been raised in a, going to a church where they told me I was an irredeemable sinner, pretty much was what they told me, as I perceived it at the time, anyway. And so I kind of grew away from the church and spiritual things, but it never went away from the back of my mind. And I've always had a spiritual side, and probably, as I think about it, more and more, I it's very important to me, my spiritual life. And Linda and I do the same. We read to each other every morning from various spiritual books. And I remember passing, I think it was Wayne Dyer on a PBS fundraiser locally in the very, very early part of this century. I remember he had a model of a molecule, I guess, and he kind of pointed to the atoms, and then the electrons, and neutrons, and protons, and then the quarks, and he said in the center of everything there is nothing but energy, and I thought of thinking about that. I thought, well, that means something else is going on, at least for me. I know a lot of people, like my own son, my eldest son, we have talks about this, and he's a hard-line mathematician scientist kind of guy. And so, you know, it's just one of those, it's never an argument because those things are unwinnable. But, you know, from my point of view, it's, you know, I really do believe that we are all of one spirit in a way, and at least that's the way we're intended to be when we're behaving ourselves and are nice to each other and all those things like kindness and love. And I just think that that's what we are, spiritual more than material. And so that informs Danny's outlook in this book. Not in every book I write, but in this one, he very much is, you know, thinking in that kind of loose framework. And, you know, for me anyway, as time goes by, I get to be more comfortable with that. And I like my, you know, my spiritual way of looking at the world. And he does too. And in fact, it becomes part of his time travel sort of methodology, pardon that word, and along with, you know, physics and metaphysics. And so there's a good deal of that, but I think that they all intertwine anyway, physics and metaphysics. So
right. So let's see. I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this. There are a lot of authors who are trying to kind of infuse their books with metaphysical and spiritual lessons, so to speak. And It can be done really badly.
Yeah.
And when I started reading your book and you know, Books Forward, your publicist sent it to me, and I get a lot of books from them. I get a lot of books from other publicists, so I, you know, get a lot of requests from authors, and I try and give everyone a chance. And to be honest, I wasn't expecting much from this.
Oh.
And I was pleasantly surprised. I am actually quite amazed at how well you handled that, and how, you know, you can learn, someone reading this can learn a lot, and or at least get exposed to a lot of different ideas, but not in a heavy-handed way. It's all very delightful.
Well, thank you. That's very nice to hear. I know that for me, when I read that kind of area of things, what I hate most is a kind of a shaming, in effect, sort of voice to be reading that. I don't want to do that because, first of all, I am in no position to shame anyone because I just came to whatever I might think I know very late in life. So I'm just feeling my way, as I think most of us are who are interested in that kind of thing.
I think maybe it helps that you've got a dog giving some of the lessons.
Yeah, I like that too. I like that too.
And also there's some drug trips going on in here.
Right.
And
well, he's a child of the 60s and the 70s.
And this could be and this can also be done really, I don't know, just in a way that is just very trite and uninteresting, but you didn't. You actually made it fun to read, and I'm really quite impressed this book was a very ambitious undertaking. It's a story within a story, or a play within a play, kind of, you know, because the character's making a movie. You know, he goes back in time, and then he's making a movie about a character. And it's sort of, it's like there's so many layers to it. And I feel, and now admittedly, I haven't finished it yet, but I feel like you've pulled it off.
I hope so. I it feels that way to me. To be honest, of all the things I've written, including, you know, probably a pile of plays and failed novels as high as, you know, you know, up to close to my shoulder or something. I feel that this is the one that's most nearly been accomplished with some that has a little depth to it. I just came across, Monica, I just came across something here. It's a page. You were speaking of the dog, and I like this page, and I was wondering if there's time to read that.
Sure.
Okay. It's after Danny, back in time, has run into Samantha, back in time. He's seen her young, and it's just almost, you know, he's almost passed out from the experience. But anyway, you know, I'll just give it one extra paragraph. I saw Sam. I saw her young. Age doesn't make any difference. Isn't that a nice thing about getting older? Your beloved stays as beautiful to you as she always was. I wasn't any more attracted to the youthful Sam I just saw than the one I've spent my life with, each day, every night. There's no difference between the two Samanthas, none. So is it not a physical attraction? Has it become some kind of spiritual thing? No, that's not right. Time, space, biology, all of it comes together in Sam into something there is no way I could imagine proving. When I look at her, for example, the last time I looked at her before today in Valley Glen, I never see what a kid would call an old lady. I see everything about her, and it is nothing less than perfect, beyond time. And then there's a break, and there's another little piece here, if I may.
Sure.
It's in italics, so it's the voice of Tally, is their dog, who is also a time traveler, incidentally.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, guys who think they're big shots take big shot risks. That's what you just did. You do understand that, don't you? I look in my rearview mirror and see him growing larger, closer, realer. He's trotting toward me as I slow down, pull over to the side of the road and stop. I'm still on Laurel, about 100 feet south of Mulholland Drive. Tongue hanging, lips curled up as if in a smile. It can't be, but it is. My four-legged friend from another time just showed up. Right, he says, and sometimes when you're least expecting it, I'll do it again. Okay, I say. I've maneuvered my right leg over the gear shift console, and I'm leaning over as near as I can to the passenger side window. He's standing on the ground there, 3 feet from the car, looking at me from almost my eye level. So meanwhile, I ask him, what are you doing here? What do you want from me? He shakes himself all over as if he's materialized from out of a lake. Let's try to cast you in a position in a positive light for a moment. You've gotten yourself caught up in something that seems to have turned out to be a mistake, not knowing it was your suggestible mind that enabled it. You have attempted something unique. Maybe it was a mistake. He looks me straight in the eye in that way he has. But it couldn't hurt, he continues, for you to remember Mr. Einstein's words. Anyone who has never made a mistake has never tried anything new. What do you think? But how do I know my mistake is correctable? You don't, he says. Then what good are you doing me? And Tally says, you remember telling me I was God backwards? That it would even enter your mind to say that is one of the many swinging doors to your problem. You thought when you found me at the Animal Rescue Center that you were rescuing me. But if you will remember, it was I who chose you. I showed up in your life to rescue you, not the other way around. I'm aware that you recognize the God in me, but understand that I have always seen the emerging dog in you. And to answer your earlier question as best I can for the moment, that's what I'm doing here. That's it.
Now, do you have a dog?
We don't right now. We lost our beloved poodle. He was a rescue poodle we got, I don't know, many years ago now. And we haven't gotten a new dog yet because it's still too painful.
Mm.
It's just amazing. I'd never quite realized how painful the passing of a pet can be.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. So, Rick, you mentioned that you have kind of a stack of failed novels. How many did you not publish, and how do you decide which ones to move forward with?
One of the things I learned so slowly, it reminded me of standing in front of the geometry class one time in 10th grade, and I hadn't done my homework, and I was supposed to do whatever you do with the figure on the figures on the blackboard, and his name was Mr. Holdeman, and I kind of faced the figures on the blackboard and said, and did nothing, and he said, "Rather dense this morning, aren't we, Mr. Lenz?" And I was indeed, and I was then about novel writing too. I kept reworking already done material, thinking that there was this good part here, and so I can keep. I would do it again and again and again, in new forms, before I finally realized that this was getting me nowhere, and that if I wrote something that didn't seem decent 6 months later, that I'd better well throw it out. Hmm. And when I finally started to learn to do that, then I began writing new stuff, and then gave myself a chance to not write the junk I'd written before.
Well, it certainly seems to have worked. You may have been a little dense, but you got where you needed to go. And we're out of time. And, of course, time is a very important part of your book, Hello, Rest of My Life.
Yeah.
And, in fact, we always close with a quote, and I'm going to read a quote from the beginning of the book that's about time. Time is too slow for those who wait, too swift for those who fear, too long for those who grieve, too short for those who rejoice, but for those who love, time is not. And that's from Henry Van Dyke.
Yeah, I love that quote.
Well, thank you for being with us today, Rick.
Oh, Monica, thank you. It's been a joy, and I apologize if I've monologued more than I should, but
that's,
you just got me going.
That's what we're here for. So thank you, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Please say hi to Caroline for me.
I will do that.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.